Today I would like to introduce Ben Turner, who is visiting us from Texas. He's talking to us about how we might quantify quantum non-localities.
Okay, thanks John. Good afternoon everyone, and thanks for inviting me to visit. So what I want to take you through today are some of the highlights from my thesis. So this means some of the work some of you will already be familiar with. But I promise there's something there that's new for everyone. Okay, so the debate about whether there could be some hidden variable theory to describe quantum theory and the predictions it makes dates back to this famous paper, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, who asked, can the quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete? And as we all know, it was not till Bell came along 40 years later that people realized that you could actually answer this question by doing experiments, rather than it just being some sort of philosophical discussion. And so the history goes to David Bohm, who reformulated Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen's paradox for spin half systems. Before Bell came along with his formalism of Bell inequalities. So in the talk today, just for concreteness, I'm going to focus on the correlations on an EPR pair. So that's this thing. And we suppose it's shared by two parties, Alice and Bob. Alice is played by Alice from Wonderland. Bob is played by a Bob Dylan impersonator. It's not Bob Dylan himself. And Alice measures her qubit along an axis parametrized by an angle A hat. Bob along an axis parametrized by an angle B hat. And then they get outcomes labeled by alpha and beta. And then when you do this, you find that you get these correlations. The local outputs are completely random. Expectation value of alpha is zero. Same with beta, but they're correlated so that if you multiply the outputs together, the expectation value of that is the negative of the dot product, the angles between their two axes. Okay, so why are these correlations non-local? What does that mean? Well, I'm going to formulate this in terms of a game. So this thing called the CHSH game is defined as follows. So Alice and Bob are playing against me.
You're Charlie?
No, I'm Ben.
All right.
Yes, I'm trying to introduce you before I guess you're here at that point.
Sorry, I missed that.
Okay. So it works like this. Alice and Bob agree on a strategy, and then they separate and they're not allowed to talk to each other. And then I choose two bits, I and J, and I choose them uniformly at random and send one to Alice and one to Bob. And then they send me back two bits. And then they win if this condition holds. This is just the XOR of their two bits. That has to be the AND of the bits they send. And it's easy to see that it's possible for them to win with probability half just by sending random things back at me. And so we parameterized the winning probability by this thing, and why it's this will become apparent on the next slide. And it turns out that if they're only allowed to share randomness, they can win this game with probability 3/4, whereas if they share an EPR pair, they can win with higher probability. Right, and this is what we're seeing here is Bell inequality violation. So this is the CHSH inequality, the simplest possible Bell inequality, it's the fact that these two numbers differ that gives the simplest proof that there's no possible local hidden variables model for quantum theory. So in physicist language, the classical value of this thing is bounded by 2, whereas we can achieve 2 root 2 with a quantum value, with some quantum strategy. So let me tell you what a hidden variables model is, what a local hidden variables model is, just by way of a picture. So we have a local hidden variables model on this side. So in the context of a game, it works as follows. Alice and Bob, they share some random string, can be arbitrarily long, and then I send them their inputs, and then their answers have to be determined by their inputs and the value of this random string, somehow by any means, any function. Whereas for a quantum strategy for this game, they're allowed this sorry, Scott is grimacing at me. They're allowed to share an EPR pair or arbitrary entanglement, and they can make measurements on the shared state and use the measurement outcomes to come up with answers. Okay, so you know, this number is bigger than this number, but it's not clear what these numbers mean physically. This is some sort of game. It's not clear how this relates to experiments you might do and so forth. And so the subject of this talk is to devise more physical measures of non-locality. So what does the fact that this sort of difference is 2 root 2 minus 2 mean? What does the fact that the ratio is root 2 mean? So we'll look for more physical measures.
What's wrong with a monetary measure?
A monetary measure?
Yeah.
Monetary, as in finite?
Well, the odds that you're willing to give when you play this game.
When we're doing an experiment, I mean, there's nothing wrong with this measure, but I'm just looking for something more physical. When we're doing an experiment, there's no games involved. Like people don't write papers about playing games against their equipment or anything, right? They write papers about how much noise they had in their apparatus or how inefficient their detectors were, or these sorts of physical things. Right. So this is a very, I'd call this like a computer science measure, and we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that later.
If you did call it a game, probably PRL wouldn't accept it.
Cheating, yeah. You could argue your results were bad because your apparatus was cheating.
I think it's an economic measure.
Sorry?
It's an economic measure.
Okay, it's an economic measure, but we're physicists.
Well, I don't know. You're not worried about that at all.
Did you
want to play that game
with you? Okay, so the measure that Beth advocates is the obvious one, which is this ratio of the Ohm equality violation, or we can call this an economic measure or so forth. It actually has a good meaning in terms of interactive proof systems, which we'll get to later. I want to talk about some other measures. The first is a communication cost of classical simulation. So let's suppose we want to actually produce these correlations via some sort of hidden variable theory. How non-local does it have to be? How much non-local instantaneous communication between the various parties do we need? Another measure, what detector inefficiency is required so that there's no there's a loophole free we can do a loophole free test that quantum theory is non-local in a sense. How much noise can we add to the EPR pair or an arbitrary quantum state before there is a local hidden variable model? What's the statistical difference of the correlations we get from quantum theory compared to the best possible local model? So I'm going to talk about all these measures. But not this one. This is due to Wim Van Dam and collaborators. Okay, so I've done the introduction. The body of the talk. will consist of going through and looking at these measures. I'll have 2 slides or so on interactive proof systems, so we can make the connection with this ratio of Ohm equality violation or this economic measure that's been advocated strongly by the left side of the room, and then finally I'll discuss something that's slightly different but still related to non-locality, which is that these non-local correlations are monomers in a similar way to entanglement.
So you're asking for her approval to do this?
No. I know better than to do that. Okay, so here's this first measure, the communication cost of simulating these correlations. So let's start with the local protocol. So that means we share some random string, and this is known as the local hidden variables. And then the two parties, Alice and Bob, separate, and I ask them questions, or I keep them, they choose measurements. And then they output bits that depend on the choice of measurement and the value of the random string. And I'm just going to modify this slightly to add an extra stage in here, where between getting the measurement and outputting results, they're allowed to talk a little bit. They're allowed to exchange a series of messages, a certain number of bits of communication. And we want to know how many bits of communication do they need here in order that they can reproduce the non-local correlations of interest in this case. So it's underneath the output. And this has been introduced independently by a number of people. Okay, so firstly, why is this hard? These are the correlations I want to produce. So the naive way to do this would be for Alice to make a measurement on her side, or to simulate that, and then send what she did to Bob, so send her measurement access and output, right? But this takes an infinite number of bits, because she has to specify whether access is there or there. It's a continuum, right? And so it was quite surprising that you could do this with a finite number of bits, and this has been improving steadily. It's been improving since the result that I'm going to tell you about today. But I'm going to show you that one bit is sufficient today. And so this has been improved more recently to show that you don't even need a bit of communication. You can use what's known as a dozen one local box. And if you don't know what it is, it's not really very important.
To simulate one NPR pair?
To simulate the correlations on an NPR pair.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to be focusing on that all through this section.
And this is just for projection value measures?
This is just for the correlations I listed here. So it's just for projected measures. Okay, and this bit is called the bacon bit. Up to date. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just go through and explain the protocol, but I won't prove it, or I won't tell you how it works, because we don't have time. So the first question to ask is, well, how close can we get to those correlations on the previous slide if we have a local hidden variable model? And so Bell was the first to do this when the way it went was he was trying to come up with a hidden variable model for quantum theory, and he couldn't do it, and then this led to him running down these Bell inequalities. And so the best you can do is as follows. Alice and Bob share some unit vector on the sphere. This is the block sphere. And if Alice is in the top half of the sphere, according to this unit vector, she outputs -1. If she's in the bottom half, she outputs +1. And Bob does the opposite. So the cosine curve are the correlations we want to simulate, where cosine of r is minus 8 of the minus 9 is missing. So this is the angle between the measurement axes plotted against the expectation value of this joint correlation. Right? So these are the correlations we want to simulate. This local model, this best possible local model, gives you these correlations, and you can't do any better than that with the local model. So let's try and modify that minimally. Well, rather than sharing one unit vector, then I'll share two unit vectors. So these divide the block sphere into four segments now. according to the signs of the dot products with an arbitrary point in that sphere. And we'll have Alice do exactly the same as before. If she's in the top half, she'll have output minus one. If she's in the bottom half, she'll have output plus one. Right, and that now I have to specify what she sends, because this is a protocol where she sends one bit. This is the communication required. And so she'll send minus one if she's in either of these two sectors. And she'll send plus one if she's in either of these two sectors. So the reason that it's these two, say, and not half the space, is because if Alice's measurement is in here, then that's equivalent to just getting the opposite result if she measured along the opposite axis. And so really we only need to worry about what goes on in half of this space. Okay, and now Bob's output is determined by these shared vectors and also by the bit he received from Alice. So if he receives minus one, his output looks like this, and if he receives plus one, his output looks like this. Okay, so let's consider this all at once. Let's suppose that Alice sends plus one. So there's her axis there. Then if Bob got the same, if Bob is given this axis to measure along, then it's possible that Alice was given the same axis, because this is in the region where Alice told Bob her vector lay. And so it must be the case that he outputs the opposite of what Alice did in this region. Right. So in the shaded region, Bob's output is fixed. He has to do exactly the opposite of what Alice did, because we know that if you measure an EPR pair along the same axis, they have to get completely opposite results. And then we get this just by doing the obvious thing, and so that would be this region is white, this region is orange, and you just divide the remaining region up. Okay, so it's very simple. And it's quite a surprise that it turned out to be so simple. And I'm not really going to attempt to explain how it works. But this paper gives some intuition into why it does. The obvious question to ask while I'm at Perimeter Institute is: can we motivate this protocol from some deeper reasons? Can we develop this into a full blown interpretation of quantum theory? And so how might this look? Well, we might look for some explicit hidden variable model, like de Broglie-Bohm theory or so forth, but one that's not you know, manifestly completely non-local. Like in de Broglie-Bohm theory, when one particle, all the particles in the universe have to send their position to all the other particles, you might look for some hidden variable model where you only have finite capacities. Between space-like separated intervals, so you only send a finite number of bits down these channels rather than an infinite number, and this would be very nice if it works. But it seems that if there is such an interpretation like this, it has to be very messy. Each particle has to remember exactly not who they're entangled with, but who they've ever been entangled with. And so something like this isn't necessarily going to work. Or you could do it, but it won't necessarily look nice. And there's no point coming up with an interpretation of quantum theory that looks horrible. I don't think we need that. And so we can take this idea a little further and run with it, if you will. And so in this model where we have communication, we can do the same thing Bell did and write down Bell inequalities. And we've done that. This can be generalized to outcome measurements, but we don't know how to do general measurements. And we can do some things with multi-product states. But it's all very limited.
Then you can do two outcome POVMs.
We can do two outcome POVMs.
Right, but not.
But we can't do say. If we relax the requirement that we have to use finite capacity in the workspace, if we just want to use a finite communication on average, then we can do everything. But this doesn't seem as interesting. Okay, so let me move on to the second measure. I've chosen, which is the detector efficiency required to perform a loophole-free test of Bell inequality violation. Okay. So let me tell you what this is. So what's the detection loophole? Well, let me just read. To verify Bell inequality violation with inefficient detectors, you need to renormalize to work out probabilities based on the events you actually detected, right? But if the probability of the detector firing depends on the particular value of say, a hidden variable that the states can carry, then you're selecting a biased sample. And so it's possible if your detectors aren't sufficiently efficient, it can look like quantum theory is non-local, but really it isn't. It's just a conspiracy in your apparatus. And for the CHSH inequality, which I introduced at the start of the talk, you need detectors efficiently at least 83%. And so this loophole was closed in 2001 by Mary Gorup in Dave Wineland's group, where with ions you can achieve that sort of efficiency. But it hasn't been closed with photons. And in particular, it hasn't been closed in combination with the locality loophole. So what's the locality loophole? Well, we've seen that if we're allowed communication, we can reproduce these quantum correlations with some sort of classical model. And so if you're doing a test of Bell inequality violation, you want Alice and Bob to be space-like separated. In particular, you don't want there to be time for Bob's measurement choice to propagate to Alice's lab. And so that her output could be dependent on what Bob did. And so these two loopholes haven't been closed together. And so moving beyond the CHSH inequality, the question is, how efficient do your detectors need to be? And so based on this previous protocol, we can construct hidden variable models with inefficient detectors to give bounds on this. So still fixing on this case of projected measurements on an EPR pair, here's what the picture looks like. For detector efficiencies above 82.8%, as I had on the previous slide, we get loophole-free violation of the CHSH inequality. We can construct a hidden variable model for detectors with efficiency up to 74.6%. And so there's still this gap where we don't know what goes on. And if I further restrict measurements to the equator of the block sphere, so now Alice and Bob are restricted to choosing measurements from the XY plane, then we have a local hidden variable model that goes up to here. And so this work closes the gap somewhat.
Is this for separate experiments, one concerned with detector efficiency and other with the molecule flow, or combining?
Okay, so this is just looking at the detection loophole. They're really, from an experimental point of view, they're different things. You can close one without the other, or you could do a test that close both at once. Does that address? Okay, the next measure I want to discuss is the amount of noise that can be added before the correlations become local, right? And so this also gives a measure of how non-local a particular state is. And here we get a similar picture, but it's a little more complicated. So let's again fix on projected measurements on EPRP, and so when I add some noise, so we'll have an EPR pair with probability p and white noise with probability 1 minus p. This is known as a Banner state. And so what are the properties of this thing? Well, for p less than a third, this is separable. And Werner gave a local hidden variable model that was valid for p less than half. So why was this interesting when he did this? Well, he showed that these notions of whether a state is entangled and whether the correlations on that are non-local, they're distinct notions. In the case of pure states, they turn out to be the same. Every pure state violates some Bellman equality. Correlations on every pure state are non-local. But for mixed states, this isn't the case, as he showed. And this is the one case where we can, John can extend this argument to POVMs. And so for p less than 5 twelfths, there's also a local hidden variable theory for general measurements, or generalized measurements on this state.
And for p greater than a third, it is entangled.
It is entangled, yes. Yes, it's entangled and distillable. Yes. Where these correlations, where the Werner state starts to violate this, right? And now we minimize that value over all possible Bellman equalities, and then you arrive at this. So, I mean, that could be one definition. There are others. It comes from Banach's space theory. I don't want to write it down because it's rather long involved. But I can show you afterwards.
You minimize or maximize?
You minimize the value of p. Because for a fixed Bellman equality, we violate it at some point. you want to know what is the best spell on the body. I'll show you afterwards.
Your mind, like, for the local hidden variables theory, go from something up to something, so it seems to include small values. I mean, small values of P.
Okay, so when P is small,
yeah.
This thing is easy to simulate the correlations on because it just looks like a maximally mixed state. Right? When P is 1, this is an EPR pair, and we know it's not possible to reproduce these correlations with the local theory. Right? And so the question is, how low does P need to be before a local model starts to exist?
Nice.
And so if we look at, say, a particular Bellman quality, like its CHSH inequality, then that's violated above this value. But there's probably something better. And it's there are reasons. I mean, I can give you an example, but I can't prove it. But we can. Anyway, so if we restrict measurements to the plane again, then we can give these correlations are local, if and only if the state satisfies the CHSH.
So at this point, 6.6, is that a known lower bound there on this model, KG3?
Yeah, so it's an upper bound on KG3, which corresponds to a lower bound on P. Okay, and moreover, one can go into the proof of that upper bound, and you can extract out an explicit local hidden variable model. And I'm not going to subject you to that because it's really horrible. But you do get something constructive from that. Okay, so let's go back to this original measure, this ratio of Bell inequality violation, or this economic measure of non-locality. And it turns out that this is actually relevant in a computer science context. And I'm going to keep this section short because I wanted to focus on physics in this talk. So I won't define any complexity classes or so forth, but I'll just give you an idea of things. So here's me. Right, and I have some question I want to know the answer to. So, you know, in the computer science way, it's some string in some language. But you know, you can think of this at least two graphs isomorphic, or just some question, right? And I'm kind of done. So, I go talk to Alexi, right? Who's really smart. And the question is through interaction with Alexi. Can I become convinced that this string is in the language? So let me describe the model more specifically. So if we go up here, the verifier, that's me, is efficient. So I can compute in a randomized polynomial time or randomized quantum polynomial time.
And Alexi can't talk to himself.
Yeah, so we could have a model with one Alexi, where I just talk to Alexi, or I can have multiple provers. And so the situation I want to consider is where we have multiple provers. And the rules are the same as in my CHSH game. They can agree on the strategy beforehand, but once I start talking to them, they're not allowed to communicate. Right? And so I'll get back to this once I finish defining Alexi's power. The model is that the verifier, that's me, is efficient, and the provers are computationally unbounded. However, they're also untrustworthy. So the provers are always trying to convince me that this string is in the language, even if it's not. And I have to be able to detect when they're doing this, if the language is going to have some interactive free system of this form. And so if the string isn't in the language, then there shouldn't be any strategy for the provers, such that I accept with high probability, such that I end up thinking that the string is in the language. And conversely, if the string is in the language, then there should be some way for them to convince me of this, if the language has an interactive fruit system. Right? Now, it turns out that you gain more power if you can talk to more provers who can't talk to each other. And this is kind of because you can check your answers against each other. So if we just had one prover to talk to, I'd ask him a question, he'd give me an answer, I'd ask him another question. He could base his answer to that second question on what he already told me or what I already asked him. But if I have multiple people I can talk to, then because they don't know what question I asked the other guys, this gives me more power. And I'm not going to be precise about what that power is. So why are these systems in my talk? Well, these provers are supposed to be computationally unbounded. Right? So it seems reasonable to let them share entanglement. But it turns out that if you do let them share entanglement, then this can profoundly affect the soundness of classical fruit systems, the fruit systems that are sound against classical provers. And so if you just take a classical proof system and let the provers share entanglement, then this might let them convince you of things that aren't true. It could go the other way. So it could be that you can prove more things if the provers are allowed to share entanglement.
There's no example of that, no?
Yeah, and I mean, it's very unlikely to be true. Okay, so I want to give you a toy example of this, and it's motivated by the fact that I want to use it in the next part of my talk, more than anything else. So I'm going to think of this proof system as a game. So we have two parties, Alice and Bob, and they're now the provers. Okay, and this is going to be a one-round proof system. So I'll ask questions, I'll send back answers, and then I'll decide whether my strings are the language. So they're going to be, this is a proof system for graph 2 colorability. So the provers are trying to convince me, I have a graph, the provers are trying to convince me that it's 2 colorable. Okay? Now this is a silly thing to have an interactive proof for, because you know I can work out whether myself, I can work out for myself whether a graph is bipartite very easily. And so that's why I say it's a toy example. However, I will mention it is true in a complexity theoretic sense that we do have examples where you do strictly weaken this proof system for examples that aren't silly like this. Okay, so the way this proof system works is I choose an integer at random, so they're going to be trying to convince me that this odd cycle is 2 colorable, right? And it's not because it's an odd cycle. We try and color it green, red, and then you have a problem. So you see that this isn't 2 colorable. But the provers are going to try and be convincing me that it is because they're provers. So here's how the protocol works. I choose a vertex and send it to Alice. And then with probability half, I send the same vertex to Bob. And with probability half, I send an adjacent vertex. And if I send them the same vertices, they have to send me the same colors back. And if I send adjacent vertices, they have to send different colors back. And if they can do this with probability 1, if classical provers can do this with probability 1, then it means that the graph is 2 colorable. And so because this odd cycle here isn't 2 colorable, the classical provers have to get at least one question wrong. And so the value of the game is just the maximum probability of winning. And so it's given by this. If they share entanglement, there's some strategy such that such that they can cheat and win with higher probability. But it's still not one in this particular example. Okay, so I now ask you to keep this example in mind, and we'll come back to it in about 10 minutes. Before I go on, I do want to emphasize that now we see these things here, these values of these games, or these probabilities of causing the verifier to accept. These are exactly the numbers that appear in Bell inequality violation. This is the equivalent of the 2√2 for the CHS game, SH game. This is the equivalent of the 2, right? And so that measure of non-locality, that's the ratio of violation and say a Bell inequality, we see that reappear here in this computational context. Okay, and now this brings me to the last section of my talk, which is that non-local quantum correlations are monogamous in a similar way to entanglement. Okay, so ignore that guy over there. So here we have Alice and Bob, and they share an EPR pair. And I know that if they share this EPR pair, then their systems must be completely uncorrelated with someone else, their Charlie. And so the joint system of Alice, Bob, and Charlie must be in this tensor product form. And so this is known as the monogamy of entanglement. And note that Charlie is not even classically correlated with Alice and Bob. He's completely uncorrelated with them. So this is a very standard thing. We can make it quantitative, as these authors have done. And this is related to the security of quantum key distribution schemes. So if we think of, say, the Eckert scheme of cryptography, we distribute EPR pairs, we check that they're good, and then I just measure them in the same direction, and my correlation, and we end up with a secret key. And the reason we know an eavesdropper doesn't have information about that key is because of this monogamy of entanglement property, that any eavesdropper must be completely uncorrelated with this if it was true that we shared an EPR space. So, question for the audience. Does anyone know who Charlie is? It's really easy.
One of the boss of the angels?
Yeah. So his voice is the boss of the angels. So, John thought that. So I want to move from entanglement to correlations. So you win. Something. A copy of the talk. So let's think about if there's a similar thing for classical correlations. So what are classical correlations? Well, the parties can share, Alice, Bob, and Charlie will share randomness. And then rather than having measurements, let's say they have some random variables. And the question is, if we have a fixed joint distribution for Alice and Bob, does this affect what joint distributions for Alice and Charlie are possible? And the answer is no. Apart from the fact that the marginal probability distribution of Alice has to be the same. So this is all obvious. This property. So sometimes when we write out obvious things, they become a little unclear. But this should be obvious. There's no monogamy in classical probability. And so let me go to the quantum state. Rather than sharing randomness, the parties will share some quantum state, and they each have, say, plus or minus one valued observables rather than random variables. And then I look at the joint distribution of Alice and Bob's measurement outcomes. And it's true that if we choose this, then this can restrict which possible joint distributions of Alice and Charlie are allowed. But for this to be the case, the correlations can't have a classical local hidden variable description, because we know that classical correlations aren't monogamous. And so that's where we get the connection with non-locality. We can only have monogamy if our correlations are non-local. So let's go to the simplest example again, which is the CHSH inequality from the start of the talk. So we have three parties that share a common state of arbitrary size, not necessarily an EPR pair or anything. And each party has two plus or minus one valued observables. And I look at the value of this CHSH operator for Alice and Bob and for Alice and Charlie. And the question is there some trade-off between these two things? If Alice and Bob violate the inequality, can Alice and Charlie too? And it turns out that the sum of these two things, which, if you remember in quantum theory, can each of these individually can be 2 root 2, the sum has to be bounded by 4. And in particular, if we generalize this to lots of parties, Alice can only violate the CHSH inequality with one of these people, not with more than one. So, how do we?
Just assuming she has only one qubit.
No. That's assuming that the measurements are the same. Sorry, I should. That's a really good point. Thank you for bringing it up. Okay, so the restriction here is that Alice has these two measurements, right? And we put the same measurements in each of these operators, right? So of course it's certainly possible that Alice and Bob can share an EPR pair, and then they violate the CHSH inequality maximally, and Alice and Charlie share an EPR pair, and they do the same thing. But in that case, Alice has to use different measurements. And so the assumption here is on the measurements, not on the dimension, which is what makes this different from the monogamy of entanglement.
I see. Okay, and what if Alice had only one qubit, then you get a similar sound?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It turns out it's slightly weaker, but there is some trade-off.
Okay.
Just from the
Kaufman
Klundig-Williams expression. And so one might use results like this when in situations where you can't place a bound on the dimension of the state. Say in interactive proofs, the provers are all powerful, so we can't a priori say how much entanglement they share. They can have arbitrary amounts. Or if we want to make a very strong security proof for key distribution, then we might let the eavesdropper change the number of qubits in the state that we measure. Or you know, we could go even further and give the eavesdropper even more power. So let me just say some words about how this result was obtained. In general, it's hard to work out what the maximum probability for what the maximum quantum value of a Bell inequality is, and by this I mean it's hard in that we don't really have any good techniques yet, but probably someone will come along and give us some not hard in a computational sense, and so the way I put this is that it might just make the simple observation that quantum correlations don't allow you to send signals instantaneously just by making measurements on some shared state. And so it turns out this result is also true for no signaling theories. And for no signaling theories, working out the maximum violation of Bell inequality is easy. You just have to solve the linear program. And so you can just do this. So let me draw that because it makes things clearer. So on the y-axis, I've plotted this value of the CHSH inequality operator for Alice and Bob. and on the x-axis for Alice and Charlie. So classically, each of these things are bounded between minus 2 and 2. And they can independently, each of these classically these two things are independent. And so if we ask, well, what possible joint values of these two things are allowed, classically, you just get this square here. So there's no Menard restriction. For no signaling theories, and therefore also for no signaling theories and quantum theories, the bound I had on the previous page corresponds to this diamond. Right? So we see that the sum is to be at most 4. And in fact, for no signaling theories, this diamond here characterizes precisely which values of these two things are allowed. I know that because these corner points are allowed for no signaling theories, so is everything in the middle. And so this leads to an obvious question. Well, what's the region precisely of these two things, which is allowed by quantum theory? And we know it's a result by Cyrilson. We know that each of these individually can't be greater than 2 root 2. And so certainly this region up here isn't allowed. Rather magically at this stage, it turns out, we know all these points are on the edge of the quantum region, and rather magically it turns out they all lie on a circle, and indeed this is the allowed quantum region, this circle. And then this figure is, you know. Right, this thing is cool, so you just have to do something like that. Okay, so let me write this down. That's this result. The allowed quantum region is a circle. And so observe that we get a Cyrilson's bound as a corollary of this. So this is strictly stronger than Cyrilson's bound. The one of these must be less than it plus the square of something else. And so each of these things individually is less than 2 root 2. And this has the potential to be interesting, is the right way to say it. Because this number is quite mysterious. It's not clear why that's the maximum value allowed by quantum theory. And this is a... there's been a lot of speculation as to where this number comes from, if anyone knows why the quantum region should be a circle on the previous page,
because quantum mechanics likes the LT book.
I know, that's my explanation too. But
what else
could
it be? No, classical theories like the L1 or quantum mechanics.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, exactly. But why do you get the circle when you plot these things? And why were you thinking about monogamy? What's? I mean, there's a lot more to think about. So I don't know the answers to that. Anyway, so now let's this will be the final thing I do. Let me go back to this odd cycle game I showed you 10 minutes ago, and let's try and do something with these observations I've made about monogamy. Well, let's do this. Let's add another prover, right? And the way I'm going to add the prover is that I'll just ask this prover same question I asked Bob. So I'll send the vertex to Alice, and then I'll send the same vertex to these two. And then in this modifier game, the players win in the sense that they convince me that the graph is too colorable. If the original players do in the original game, and these two guys agree, they both send back the same answer. And when you do this, you find that the provers can't gain any additional advantage by sharing entanglement. And so for this specific example, you see that we've succeeded in preventing the provers from cheating by sharing entanglement. And we can flip this round to make a connection with things that people here have worked on. Let's suppose now that Alice and Bob do win the game, do convince us with probability higher than this, they do violate this Bell inequality. Then this limits how correlated Charlie can be with Bob. And so if we think of Charlie as an eavesdropper, and Alice and Bob as people trying to establish a secret key, then if they do observe Bell inequality violations, then this limits how correlated they are with an eavesdropper. And so this is not exactly what you want to do for a security proof. But I mean, we already have a security proof due to people at the extremes of the second row. But it makes the connection. Okay, so I'm just going to conclude by going through what I've told you. I described work that addressed the question of, well, we know that quantum theory is non-local. We've known that for ages. Can we quantify how non-local it is, and what measures should we use to quantify that? I made a brief connection with the I made a brief connection with interactive proof systems, and then I showed you that monogamy entanglement can also also applies to non-local quantum correlations. These are also monogamous. Okay, thank you for having me.
Okay. So you mentioned some different ideas for measures of non-locality. In the case of entanglement theory, we have this nice theorem, which at least in the case of pure states is a uniqueness theorem, and says that, you know, any measure of entanglement satisfying such and such axioms is equal to the measure of entanglement. For pure states, the entropy of entanglement. And I think, as far as I remember, even in the case of mixed states, it gives you some bounds, like every measure should be between the entanglement cost and entanglement distillation, something like that. So it seems if you want to talk about different measures of non-locality, maybe a natural thing to do would be to think about what properties they should have, and these different measures that you've mentioned, do they have these properties or not? Have you thought about anything like this?
Yes. So the short answer is I don't know how to do that. I don't have some unifying set of guidelines that says what a measure of non-locality should be, that allows you to move between measures that satisfy these criteria. You can certainly move between some of these measures. Like if you have a local hidden variable model that in this case, then you can make local hidden variable models for these two scenarios. But we don't know of any way to go backwards. And so some of these do seem stronger. Yeah, I'm not sure it's clear that such a thing should exist for measures of non-locality.
I like your comments about trying to find an indirect theory that's somehow consistent with this theoretical minimums of communication. Is it clear that from interpretation is really going against that, and is it conceivable that actually, if you set the question on the correctly, well, the interpretation would exactly be
Well, when I update the pilot wave, I mean, it depends on the position of all the particles everywhere else in the universe, and these.
It doesn't actually depend on the position of the wave function factorizers. for example, they don't depend on those recommendations like the entangled bit. So, you can see what that would be.
I mean, I would think that the first thing you do is at least start with a hidden variable theory that has a discrete state space.
Yeah.
There are discrete versions of the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm afraid I'm not an expert on the Borelli bone theory. And there probably are experts in the audience, so I don't want to say too much. But I will say that we know that any model like this must have undesirable properties, such as each particle must remember all the other particles they have been entangled with in the past. And the Borelli bone theory doesn't have this property. And so there's going to be some reason why it's not what we're looking for. But I can't put my finger on what that is.
Where there isn't a wavefunction.
Right.
And the other question I had was mostly in these measures, I guess, was certainly in the measures you were looking at maximally entangled states. Do things change very much when you go to non maximally entangled states?
I mean, that's a big question. So if I specialize to qubit five-type systems, so then you get some surprising behavior and things do change. In that according to these measures, partially entangled states are more non-local than a maximally entangled state, which is perhaps some property you wouldn't want in a measure of non-locality. But things, I mean, we have results that have included them.
So for example, in the first case, do you find what would be capable result?
So in the first case, you can simulate projective measurements on an arbitrary qubit state of two bits of communication.
And you've proven that you need more than one bit.
So we've been trying to do that for ages. We don't know how to prove you need more than one bit. You can prove that we know that for an EPR pair, one non-local box is sufficient. Okay. If you're trying to reproduce the correlations on a partially entangled state, we know that one non-local box is insufficient. You need two. I mean, I can tell you what these things are for partially entangled states. So I know that there's a local hidden variables model up to 74.6% for measurements on a maximally entangled state. It turns out that if I look at a partially entangled state, and actually a state that's just entangled, then it violates the CHS inequality right down to the detector's inefficiency of 2/3.
This is the Eberhardt
result. So that's not really a physical result. You need to work on this, and then in this other measure, we have hidden variables for all states below one on growth index constant of order H rather than 3. I mean, this is getting rather technical.
Sort of something. What if you have n entangled pairs instead of one, and you were to make some joint measurement on all of them? Then, you know, do you have any intuition about how the number of bits of communication you need is going to scale?
It should scale as the dimension.
Okay, so
it should scale exponentially, and there are lower bounds that say this, but we don't have any upper bounds at all.
So there are lower bounds that you need an exponential number.
Okay, so there, if you want to do it exactly, there are lower bounds that you need an exponential number. These are due to Brassard, Cleveland, Papp in the same paper that I cited earlier.
But for approximately.
For approximately, we don't have bounds.
Okay.
Or you can probably manufacture some from Razor's communication complexity as well. Mm-hmm. So we might need to think about it.
Okay, all right.
So is it possible that exact simulation for joint measurement on n pairs of qubits would be impossible?
I guess it's possible. I don't know how to do it, so that doesn't really say anything. That neither does anyone else, so it might be.
Okay, so what about, say, one qubit? Do you know anything about two outcome measurements on one qubit? On an angled qubit?
You can do it with, like, I think it's 3 bits of communication. You can blow this up for two outcome. Two outcome measurements?
Yeah,
you can blow this up and you get like 3 bits or 4 bits.
I see. So what is the dimension where this stops working?
No. For two outcome measurements, we can do it in any dimension.
Oh, I see.
It's just, you know, two outcome measurements aren't particularly general.
I see. Okay.
Is anything known about the scaling of the communication complexity of simulating a state in the correlations of entangled state classically as the number of parties scales? Polynomial or exponential, or sort of multipartite?
I'm afraid I don't know off the top of my head.
Right. The first question would just be to look at a GHZ state with 3 choices.
Yeah, so actually to go back to Ramesh's question, the best way to, if it does turn out to be impossible to simulate things exactly, then the GHZ states of 4 or more parties seem to be good candidates for things that might be impossible.
Well, one of the things I'm asking you before, we go to 4, why stick with GHZ states? Why not use cluster states in this game?
Well, I mean, we don't know how to do them either.
But I mean, there you don't have this monogamy.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, you could have...
Right, you have robustness and persistence of entanglement.
Yeah, persistence of entanglement for, you can entangle 4 parties in a way that you can't entangle 3.
Right. Intuitively, it seems like it would make it harder to simulate.
I mean, it's kind of disappointing in a sense, because we thought once we had this, because our protocol for EPR pairs, I mean, it's so nice. We thought there'd be some straightforward generalization. We even kind of wrote the paper with this in, with this generalization before it turned out to be wrong, and we just don't know how to do it.
You know, you've got this nice, well-stated open problem. I mean, that's not so disappointing.
Thank you. Should we call it there?
Any more questions?
Okay. Thank you, everyone.